It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. On Monday, Governor Evers signed a new law to increase state funding to manage the federal food assistance program in the state, known as Food Share or SNAP. The law creates new positions at the state's Department of Health Services aimed at implementing new work and reporting requirements that were established in the Federal Reconciliation Bill, or H.R. 1, last year. The goal is to avoid hundreds of millions in penalty fees under the law for states that don't comply with new requirements. Wisconsin lawmakers also opted to include in the law a ban on using food share benefits to buy candy, soda, and energy drinks. Brooklyn Gray is food share manager for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, the largest hunger relief organization in the state. Brooklyn, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, this funding is on the administrative level. On that side of things, is this something that food share recipients are really going to see, or is this going to be kind of invisible to people who actually rely on this support?
Yeah, the hope is actually that this is invisible. This is a maintenance of the program, making sure everything continues to run well, make sure folks get their benefits on time, and everything keeps going the way it should.
And the concerns here are, hey, the states are picking up more of the tab for administration on this now under the new law and these new work requirements. Well, it's more bureaucracy. Do you see the money that the state's putting into this as it's implemented? Is that going to be enough to keep up with those changing needs and costs?
That's our hope. So a lot of the fear around losing that administrative cost was actually increasing the burden on people, their wait times and getting access to their benefits, making it even longer and harder for people to submit those documents and see their food share actually coming onto their card on time. So our hope is like this funding is coming through. DHS has these new roles in place to make sure people understand these changes, that people are still getting access to their food and still able to buy groceries in a timely and just honest manner. I do think there's a lot of fear around these changes just because the work requirement changes really did just come as a surprise for some of our seniors and some of our veterans who are getting those, going to see those impacts in the coming months. But with these changes coming down the way, our hope is that honestly, people don't see those changes and the program just runs like it should.
And last time I talked to you about this, your message was, I think it's fair to say, yes, there are some changes, but don't panic. This doesn't mean everybody out there is receiving food aid is going to lose it. Is that still your message to people you work with?
100%. Yes. We are working with anybody, everybody. If you qualify for this program, you deserve these benefits. And that is not going away. Wisconsin wants people to eat well, feed their families, support our grocers and our farmers. That is what the hope was behind this funding. That is the like everybody coming together in one room and saying, no, this is an important program, and we want to make sure that people still have these benefits. And that's what we do at Eastern Wisconsin, is we want to make sure people understand the changes, that they have the right to use these benefits, to apply for these benefits, and this program isn't going anywhere.
Now, the work requirement category change here, people might be wondering, hey, I receive food share. I'm a little confused by these changes. I don't know when they kick in or if they apply to me. How are they going to know? Are they going to get notification of some sort? What is the process for finding out if these changes apply to particular people?
Oh, absolutely. So anybody who might be impacted by these changes, so some age limit change, some exemption status has changed, all of those people who could be flagged for a possible change in the work requirement will be sent a notice in the mail when they're up for their next renewal. And every person who goes through an application for food share or a renewal for food share will be screened for all exemptions. They'll go through all the rules and regulations, just like normal. And then they will be notified, like if that change is going to impact them, they'll be given the options for support with the food share employment and training program. They'll be given time to start meeting those requirements. And a lot of times if my team or other advocates are working with people, we'll work with folks to make sure that they know their options for meeting these new rules and understanding their rights for food share.
And before we let you go, I want to get your take on the candy, soda, and energy drink restriction. And technically, this is Wisconsin applying for a waiver to the federal government. The federal government, as it exists now, is very sympathetic, I think, to this change. What's your thought on this? How will this affect people?
I mean, the first thing that we're just keeping our eyes on is just making sure that the confusion stays down, that this new rule around what you can and cannot spend food share benefits on is just understood. Right now, there's already, you can't buy certain like hot food products with food share. You can't buy non-food products with food share. This is just one of those things where you're at the grocery store. We really don't want people to get sticker shocked with their grocery bill because they expected something to be covered when it isn't. And so at the end of the day, we're just trying to make sure folks still have the power to buy their groceries, to get access to healthy food, that they have those options available to them. But we just want to make sure that there's not a surprise at the register. Folks aren't feeling that impact as those changes roll out for people. But it's months to come. So we're very curious. We're keeping our eye on that implementation as well, just so we can stand on the side of folks buying their groceries with food share.
Brooklyn, thanks again for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Brooklyn Gray, food share manager for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, the largest hunger relief organization in the state. Now we'll look at how Wisconsin's new law compares to other states around the country. Gina Plata-Nino is the SNAP director for the Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit dedicated to eradicating hunger in the U.S. Gina, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Now, your organization had concerns about the federal, it was called the One Big Beautiful Bill, would impact states when it came to food share. How do you see the new Wisconsin law, the new administrative funding, tackling some of those concerns?
It's a good step forward. You know, unfortunately, it's a first step because a lot of these provisions that we see, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country, is that we have state agencies who historically have been underfunded. And with the new provisions, all of these new provisions mean more staff capacity, more staff need. So it just puts them at a point where they have to pay an additional 25%. But it's a good step forward.
What are you seeing in other states? Is there any model you'd point to around the country that you're saying, yeah, they're really doing the best possible reaction to this law change?
All of the states are struggling. You know, it's not just in terms of a food share, but it's also healthcare. It's also other programs that got impacted by HR1. And states right now are doing their legislative session and trying to look at different avenues. We know that some states are looking at progressive tax policy, putting ballot measures to ensure that the administrative cost is there, and also planning for the benefit cost share, which, you know, almost 44 states, and depending on how things move forward, possibly other states will be joining the number that will also have to pay a portion of the benefit cost. So it's too early to tell, but I would say that California originally, when HR1 came out, did invest significantly in the state agency, and they're continuing to have conversations around that. I've yet to see other states really finalize any budget decisions. They're still in conversations.
One key to how this is being put into practice has to do with error rates, which, as I understand it, means error is, hey, you paid this person too much or you paid this person too little. Both of those count as errors. If states go above 6% error rate, they pay some kind of penalty. Wisconsin historically has been under that. What are you looking at with this error rate penalty with this big change coming through?
It's actually more complicated than that, mm-hmm. because the person could have received the exact right amount, but say that when they're reviewing it at the federal level, they notice that the landlord form is missing a phone number. Even if the information is completely correct, even if everything's correct and the benefit amount doesn't change, that counts as a technical error, and that counts as a payment error, right? But there's no error. The benefits were correct. So it's a little bit more complex than that. So what we are seeing is that we had a government shutdown. USDA, the federal entity responsible for receiving this program, gave inconsistent guidance, and the state acted along with other states following their boss's order, for lack of a better word. So anytime they change policy, anytime inconsistent guidance is there, especially now that USDA has reorganized its structure and there are less people helping state agencies to assist, We do foresee, as we've seen in the past, that states like Wisconsin or other states who are right below the 6% line may actually cross over the threshold because of the lack of support that FNS, USDA, is giving.
It sounds like you're saying that states are being set up to fail here. What would you want to see? Would you like to see federal changes to make that error rate less risky and not punish those, you know, bookkeeping errors as opposed to genuine payment errors?
Well, states were already getting penalized They have to go, they have to fix that. They have to invest. They have to pay fees. And they're asking to do all of this at the same time, like Wisconsin had to come up with the additional 25% that they're going to need beginning in October to pay administrative costs. So they are being set up to fail because they're saying, we need you to make these changes, but we're giving you less administrative funding. And we're giving you a very short period of time to implement incredibly drastic changes that requires staff learning, computer systems, individuals not being confused. So yes, states are not giving the necessary support for them to be able to do this accurately and doing it in a way that is efficient.
Then turning to the so-called junk food waiver, Wisconsin joining some other states to say, hey, we're going to restrict certain sugary food and beverage items. How big an administrative hurdle is this? How much trouble could this create at, say, a local grocery store?
We are incredibly concerned. USDA has never approved this. Even during the first Trump administration, they said no. Various congressional leaders and farm bills have said this is a terrible idea because it costs money at the federal level. It costs money at the state level. Wisconsin is allotting $3 million, I believe, to be able to run this. There's currently a lawsuit against these restrictions. We do know that retailers did an analysis, and it's going to cost millions and billions of dollars, particularly for smaller retailers who don't have the sophisticated technology. It may mean that they have to pull out of the program or say that they can no longer participate.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next as states like Wisconsin put these new policies into place?
We're looking at case closures and decreasing because all of these implementation means that less access. So we're highly concerned on what this means for Wisconsin and for other states. Our states are making difficult choices. And at the end, it means that less people will have access to the food they need.
Gina, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Gina Plata-Nino, SNAP Director for the Food Research and Action Center. Earlier, we heard from Brooklyn Gray, Food Share Manager for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, the largest hunger relief organization in the state. Been looking at state law changes to implement changes at the federal level when it comes to food share. Every state affected by those changes. Does this affect you? Do you receive food share? Are you concerned about what is changing? Do you have questions? Are you confused? Or do you provide food aid in a local agency around the state? What are you seeing among the people you work with? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, the latest on the Line 5 pipeline. Then Wisconsin communities react to revelations about sexual abuse and grooming accusations against the late labor and civil rights leader Cesar Chavez.
We together are enduring this devastating loss, and we're together going to continue to lift each other up and celebrate our community.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. In northern Wisconsin, the Canadian energy firm Enbridge is working on a $450 million rerouting of its controversial Line 5 oil and gas pipeline. While the company has secured key approvals for the project, its state permits are now being challenged in court. As WPR's Danielle Kading reports, the fight is another front in the larger battle across the Upper Midwest over pipeline projects that often pit energy and jobs against potential harm to Native American tribes and the environment.
On a side road in northern Wisconsin, Bad River Tribal member Joe Bates flies his drone over the path of the Line 5 reroute proposed by Canadian energy firm Enbridge.
They have a big right-of-way that they've cut down, laid all the trees down.
In late February, crews began clearing trees along a new 41-mile stretch of Enbridge's oil and gas pipeline. The company first proposed a new route for the pipeline 6 years ago after the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa sued Enbridge to shut down Line 5 on tribal lands, fearing the line might rupture. Back on the reservation, Joe Bates pours a cup of tea from plants collected on tribal lands.
This is Bad River medicine. Smell it.
We're visiting Bad River tribal member Sandy Derrigan at her home on the reservation. Derrigan shows off shrubs like Labrador tea and sage that she harvested in the region to use as medicines. Derrigan says the new pipeline route still threatens critical resources.
We rely on our deer meat, our fish, our wild rice. We won't have that if there's a spill.
Native people have argued that oil and gas pipelines threaten tribal lands by risking catastrophic spills that could contaminate drinking water, wetlands, and ecosystems that sustain traditional food sources. The Enbridge project is set to cross some 200 Wisconsin waterways and affect 100 acres of wetlands. In 2024, state regulators issued key permits that were challenged by the tribe and environmental groups but upheld by an administrative law judge. Enbridge's director of Midwest Region Operations, Paul Eberth, maintains that Line 5 is vital for the region's energy needs.
The Line 5 relocation project is important not just to Enbridge, but to our country, to the country of Canada, to the communities that the refined products that come from Line 5 serve.
But the group Midwest Environmental Advocates, along with the tribe, want a court to overturn state permits and halt construction. Rob Lee is a senior staff attorney with the group.
The argument against the reroute itself is the damage and the havoc that it will wreak across all of those waterways and wetlands in northern Wisconsin.
Construction would include blasting and drilling in waterways and wetlands. And Lee says the fight is not just about the reroute, but the entire pipeline. Dave Strifling of Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative says the debate over Line 5 in Wisconsin is similar to fights seen over the Dakota Access Pipeline and other projects in Minnesota and the Dakotas.
These disputes raise some of the same themes of tribal autonomy and environmental impacts and broader debates about energy independence versus renewables and climate issues that are involved here.
Line 5 now carries some 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids daily from Superior through northern Wisconsin and Michigan to Ontario. Opponents say the reroute locks in dependence on fossil fuels that contribute to global warming, and they point to the company's track record of spills. Enbridge's Paul Eberth says pipelines are safe, but they're not perfect.
Enbridge has been there to remediate, you know, any releases or spills that have happened out in the environment, and we're going to continue to be there if there are any in the future.
Supporters say the pipeline project would add $135 million to Wisconsin's economy and create 700 jobs during construction. Neil Sikich is with the Steamfitters Union Local 601.
You know, I'm working with the community about bringing on people for this project. It's good jobs, you know, and it brings in a lot of money to the community.
While Enbridge officials expect to prevail in the end, an attorney for Bad River says the tribe will never stop fighting to protect its homeland. For the Upper Midwest Newsroom, I'm Danielle Kading.
This is WPR News. Recently, a New York Times investigation revealed that famed farm labor activist and Mexican-American civil rights leader Cesar Chavez was accused of being a sexual predator by a number of women and girls. The investigation said he groomed girls and sexually abused women, including Dolores Huerta, who helped Chavez start the United Farm Workers in 1962. There's been swift fallout. Cities around the country have called for removing Chavez's name from public buildings and streets. Events celebrating his birth have been canceled, including Cesar Chavez Day in Milwaukee. In Madison, an elementary school is named after Chavez, and the school board announced it is aware of the investigation and gathering more information. To hear more, we have a panel of guests. Jocasta Zamarripa is a member of the Milwaukee Common Council. Jose Martinez is president and chief executive officer of UMOS, a Milwaukee-based social services nonprofit. And Armando Ibarra is a professor in the School for Workers and holds a joint appointment with Chicano and Latino Studies at UW-Madison. I talked with them earlier this week. Armando, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about Cesar Chavez's role in the labor movement and his connection to Wisconsin, please?
So to talk about the UFW and Cesar Chavez as a standalone chapter in the history, in the larger arc of a social justice movement by farm workers is wrong. It's part of a larger movement of workers that's been in existence for quite some time. And no doubt that the era of the farm worker movement that was co-led by Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez is the most successful era in the farm worker labor movement to date. At their height, you know, they represented over 70,000 workers in California under collective bargaining agreements. This is, you know, as those of us that study these issues, is the ultimate form of labor representation on at the employment site within the U.S. setting. There's a real connection to Wisconsin as well. As most of us know here, the connection is one of solidarity and also one of parallel movements that were taking place during this historic time in the 60s of organizing amongst farm workers. We know that Cesar Chavez came to Wisconsin to ask that Obreros Unidos, that was being led by Latinos, Mexican Americans, Tejanos, when they were building their own union here in Wisconsin, to act in solidarity with the UFW during those great boycotts of the 1960s and early 70s.
I want to get reaction out of this news of Cesar Chavez. Jose Umos has a long history in Wisconsin and has advocated for Latino agriculture workers. What is your reaction and your organization's reaction to this report from the New York Times?
First, we are very deeply saddened by these disturbing news that came out regarding the allegations against Cesar Chavez and sexual abuse. But with that said, we, as many other community leaders across the nation, have ceased to participate in anything as it relates to Cesar Chavez. However, we continue to celebrate, and I tell folks it's important to celebrate the farm worker movement. For many years now, for over 15 years, we've always had a farm worker appreciation. It is not held in March, but it's held in August. This is when the farm workers are here in Wisconsin. So we can't be dismissive of this farm worker rights and movement. And yes, we're saddened by the aspects of what has happened, but we also uplift anyone who has been part of the farm worker movement. And I'll be dismissive not to say something, but you know what? Nuestras mujeres, they were valiant to share their story. This secrecy and silence and this ability for them to disclose was so important. And, you know, if anything, we want to make sure that they know that they're not alone. We understand that many instances when they don't want to conceal what has happened to them, it's because they often go through self-blame, or in some instances, they're afraid of what they're going to say to them. But, you know, I want to be the first, if I haven't said this before, that they're not alone. You are not alone in this fight. We are here. The community is here to support you. And if you need to reclaim your voice to be able to speak out against sexual assault and violence, you have people that will stand by you and say, yes, your silence, your pain, you should not go it alone with yourself. Because we are here to support, we are here to help you, we are here to uplift you. So yes, it may have taken this long for individuals to come forth. So whatever it lies, it is important for anybody to speak out and for them not to be in despair and say that this is something that I can should take to my grave. No, it is important to speak out, because the more we speak out against sexual abuse and violence, then we have a fortitude and opportunity to stop it. Because it is... this is something that we need to stop.
And Jocasta, as an alder, you're representing a community that has a strong presence here in the Latino community. Can you tell us a little bit about how people in your district and your neighborhoods are responding to this news?
Well, this news was devastating for us just a little less than a week ago. The news broke, and I've been in two meetings in the last few days to discuss the fallout here and what needs to be done immediately. And there was an immediate reaction in support of the survivors, Dolores Huerta and, you know, Ana Murguia, Deborah Rojas. Certainly, I feel like there was a swell of emotion and certainly a desire to support those survivors. And then some really immediate decisions calling for things like the removal of our street, Cesar Chavez Drive on Milwaukee's near south side. And El Rey owners and leaders immediately moved to remove the statue that we had in the El Rey Plaza on Chavez Drive. These decisions were actions were taken very quickly, and it was quite breathtaking to see the speed at which the community moved around that.
And Jocasta, for that community, this notion that, okay, taking Cesar Chavez references down, but as we've heard from Jose and Armando, the spirit of what people had hoped that he had represented and the movement for labor and Latino people. How are people talking about trying to keep that spirit alive while moving away from this person as a symbol?
Right, exactly. We have to make sure. For instance, I mean, my first concern, you know, we had an urgent meeting. The Cesar Chavez Bid Business Improvement District hosted an urgent virtual meeting. I know Mr. Martinez and I were in that meeting early Friday morning to discuss removing the name of the street, Cesar Chavez Drive, and reverting back to South 16th Street, which is what it formerly was. And my immediate concern and the concern that others expressed was we cannot lose, you know, this, the identity of this street. I mean, Cesar Chavez Drive is known as the heart of the Latino district. I remember during redistricting, when I first got into elected office, we fought hard for them not to crack our district. And we talked about Cesar Chavez Drive being the heart of the Latino community. So we have a desire, and we made sure as we discussed legislation to remove the name that we would have include language that said we are committed to renaming the street something culturally appropriate that lifts up the supermajority Latino population.
Briefly, Armando, how do you see moving forward replacing these symbols related to Cesar Chavez with things that still honor the wider movement?
Yeah, those are that's called accountability. And I think that's the reckoning that's happening, not just in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Madison, but across the country. This reckoning where we are holding ourselves accountable as to how we respond to this New York Times story and everything that came out about the violence that Cesar Chavez perpetuated on these victims. We move forward, you know, by holding these truths, you know, these both of these truths at once, recognizing contributions that were made by the movement, but also by centering those who were harmed and strengthening accountability in our movements. We're seeing it happening today. Representative Samaripa just gave us an account of what's going on in Milwaukee. I know here in Madison, there's conversations about changing the name of a local school and some other public spaces. But also, we can continue to recognize the importance and the impact that the farm worker movement has had, not just on Latinos, but on the entirety of our society.
Jose, again, briefly, what do you want to see as you're doing things like literally renaming streets and districts and so much public iconography to, again, capture that spirit while moving on from this individual symbol?
First and foremost, the legacy is not based on one individual. The legacy, we have to understand, is based on many individuals, the sacrifices of millions of our workers. In this country, because when folks were advocating, when they were in the marches, there were a lot of farm workers that were injured in the process. There were even some that were killed in the process. And so therefore, we have to be careful that we don't become dismissive of the sacrifices that millions and millions of farm workers have made. And when I talk about farm workers, I'm talking about African Americans. I'm talking about the Filipinos, because again, the farm worker movement was just bigger than Latinos. It involved everybody, and the impacts that when you go to the South, the African Americans that had benefited from the movement and as a result of that. So my biggest concern and fear factor is that somehow this becomes a wash and they say, well, you know, we have eliminated the leadership of the farm worker movement, so there is none that we can speak of. And I'm so concerned that somehow the history becomes washed because of we're washing one individual that we identified for the farm worker movement.
As we wrap up, Jocasta, as an alder, our guest of Bataka, Jose, was talking about the work ahead. What is ahead for you in the next couple of weeks as you deal with this fallout?
Well, immediately, I myself and President Jose Perez, the Common Council President here, put together a list of the various legislative actions that have been done over the years in honor of Cesar Chavez. We put together that list. It's about 8 or 9 legislative actions, and we are beginning already to rescind them. Just today, President Perez put forward an immediate adoption to make sure to rescind some supportive resolutions that we had put forward at one point in the early 2000s to support the creation of an optional state holiday observing Cesar Chavez's birthday. That was just today on the floor of the Common Council at City Hall. And in the coming days and weeks, we're going to introduce more legislation to continue the rescinding, revoking, and repeal of a variety of things we did here at the city to honor Cesar's legacy. But at the same time, we're meeting with constituents, community leaders, stakeholders to remind them that this doesn't mean that our Latino community and immigrant communities are going to be overlooked. If anything, now more than ever, we have to lift up our families and make sure that they know that they're not alone. We together are enduring this devastating loss, and we're together going to continue to lift each other up and celebrate our community.
We'll leave it there. Jocasta, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you all.
Jose, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
And Armando, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for the invite.
Jocasta Zamarripa is a member of the Milwaukee Common Council. Jose Martinez is president and chief executive officer of UMOS, a Milwaukee-based social services nonprofit. And Armando Ibarra is a professor in the School for Workers and holds a joint appointment with Chicano and Latino Studies at UW-Madison. We've been getting their reactions to the news about labor and immigrant group leader Cesar Chavez after recent revelations about accusations of sexual abuse and grooming. Coming up, Green Bay business owners tell us how they converted an old bus into a new bookstore.
It is one of the most fun experiences that I've ever had in my life, getting to see people's reactions when they walk onto the bus for the first time.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You may have run into food trucks where people can order burritos or smash burgers or whatever from trucks parked along the road or at events or venues. Depending on where you live or travel, you might see them all the time. But how about a mobile bookstore? In the summer of last year, Sydney Vassell and Aaron Sherwood opened Loom and Lore Bookmobile. The Bookmobile travels the Green Bay area selling books at various events with a focus on romance novels. Aaron, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Sydney, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Sydney, can you share the original inspiration for opening up this mobile bookstore?
Absolutely. So Aaron and I have always been close, and we've always just chatted about kind of our day-to-day lives in general. And we've always had this grand idea that we could kind of get out from under the man, start something for ourselves, be able to uplift our community while still kind of doing something that all of our energy would kind of give us a return for. And so we've always just brainstormed and kind of bounced back and forth different things that we could do to be able to meet that goal. And we also have very complementary skills. So I've been a marketer for my whole career. Erin does project management, so she is very organized and type A, and I'm the more creative type that kind of brainstorms the wild ideas and then needs to be brought back down to earth. And so we knew that we could do something together at some point. And we kind of started seeing different mobile businesses pop up around the country and started brainstorming around that. We loved that it was an option that would be accessible to us now with kind of low overhead, something we could get started quickly and relatively inexpensive. We've both always loved reading and valued literacy in general. And we think that reading and books should be accessible for everyone. And so when we started realizing that our hometown, Green Bay, Wisconsin, had a growing demand for this kind of business and just experiences and connecting with community in general, we started really looking into something like this. And one day during one of our regular FaceTimes where we were talking about all of those good things, we got to talking about all of the above. And one of us kind of threw out a book bus. And we both kind of looked at each other like, haha. And then we both kind of looked at each other like, wait, maybe this is something that we could actually do. And so that's really where the original inspiration came from, just seeing other successful mobile businesses popping up around the country and realizing that there could be an opportunity here for us to do something we really love and could be passionate about.
And Aaron, what does it take to turn an idea and an old bus into a hopefully thriving bookstore?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was quite a journey. This all kind of came to be at the beginning of 2025. We put together a business plan and eventually got to the point where it was like, okay, next step is purchase a bus. So I went out to a little mom and pop resale shop about 45 minutes south of Madison and test drove a bus for the first time. And of course, having never driven a bus, I had no idea what I was really looking for other than, does it operate? So we then, we purchased the bus, and with the help of friends and family, we were able to do all of the renovation, you know, kind of in-house with ourselves involved, which was an incredible experience. I think we both learned so much about that process. And kind of as Sydney had said, she is the creative kind of mind, and she had the vision for what the book bus eventually was going to look like. So we had a lot of fun inspiration to follow along to kind of get that in place. We bought the bus at the end of May of 2025, and we had our official launch party at Badger State Brewing here in Green Bay on August 23rd of 2025. So it was a pretty fast-paced project that we took on, but it has been such an incredible journey, and things have been just rocking and rolling ever since.
There's actually a third name in this partnership I don't want to forget, and that is Millie. Millie, the bus. Tell us about Millie and how that name came to be.
Yeah, great question. We actually have never told this story before. I won't go into too much detail, but long story, very long story short, when we went to actually pick up the bus after Aaron had test driven this one, we'd looked at a couple other buses that we could potentially see ourselves in. And then we kind of decided this was the one we were ready to buy. And we went to actually pick up the bus from Chicago. And when that happened, we also had another mutual friend kind of doing some work on the bus for us, helping to gut it, because we had no idea what we were doing when it came to actual like metal work. And so we had a friend that was thankfully able to gut the bus for us before we picked it up. And so when we went to pick it up after the gutting had been done and the bus had already been driven before, we essentially started driving and got immediately a dash alert that said that the engine was overheating. And so Chicago's 3 hours away from Green Bay, where the bus ultimately would live and be built out the rest of the way. And so we were stranded in Chicago with an overheating bus that neither of us really knew anything about. And yeah, so when we got stranded in Chicago, we started, of course, looking around for different mechanics, anyone that was able to help us. I think, Aaron, was it a Sunday that we were doing this?
So it was a Monday. It was a Monday morning. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a Monday. And this was obviously very short notice. So we needed to find a mechanic that was able to work on buses on a Monday, if possible. And we did find our bus savior, and his name was Milton, the mechanic. Ah. And so we translated that into a bit of a more feminine name that would fit the vibe of the bus and the brand. And Millie, it was.
All right. Now, Aaron, I think people are pretty used to, in many communities, even smaller and smaller communities, buying food, right, from that food truck. What was the reaction when you showed up in Green Bay and the surrounding areas with a book truck? Are people into this idea?
Oh, absolutely. It is one of the most fun experiences that I've ever had in my life, getting to see people's reactions when they walk onto the bus for the first time. Ever since we launched in August, up until, you know, this past weekend when I was out with Millie, we're still having people who are discovering us for the first time and seeing people's faces when they're walking onto what looks like a school bus from the outside, but is actually a cute, vibey bookstore on the inside. The reactions from people have just been phenomenal. People are really excited about the idea, and it's just been cool to kind of spread that all around Northeast Wisconsin.
Sydney, I got to ask, I'm in my studio here. We've got a bunch of books on shelves, and I figure Vilas Hall took a sharp right. They're all going to come flying off. I assume people ask this, right? How do you make a stable platform for books that don't fly all over when you go from place to place?
Yes, this is definitely our topmost asked question. Aaron has told me that probably every other person that boards the bus asks about this. And the answer is tension rods. So before we start driving, we put up tension rods in every single shelf. And then when we get to our destination for the event that we're doing, we are able to just pop those out, put them in a drawer, and hide them away until the next drive. So yeah, it was a couple of different, you know, test and learn moments with figuring out what we would do about that. But the tension rods work out perfectly.
Yep, there's definitely casualties here and there a little bit, but it's not foolproof.
We're talking to the co-owners of the Loom and Laura Bookmobile in Green Bay, Aaron Sherwood and Sydney Vassell. Aaron, let's get into content. You don't have a vast warehouse of books here, so you got to focus somehow. What did you narrow down your specialties in your mobile bookstore to?
Yeah, of course. So we call ourselves romance only-ish. We definitely focus more on romance, romantic fantasy, that kind of thing. But we do try to carry a little bit for everybody. So we have romance, fantasy, we've got some thrillers, popular fiction. We have a small section of young adult novels for people who might not be quite into the romance yet. We've got a little section of nonfiction. And we also added in a little free library shelf with children's books. So when children come on the bus with their parents, they can sit there on the wheel well and pick out a book to take home with them while their parents shop, which has been really fun.
And Sydney, you're focusing, and just looking on your website, focusing on independent authors as much as you can, local authors. How are you reaching out to find those authors who might get a copy or two on the bus?
Yes, we love to prioritize, you know, diverse voices and make sure that everyone who comes onto the bus feels seen and feels represented. And actually, we've been very lucky in that many local authors or authors that write romance or romance subgenres have actually reached out to us and requested that we carry their books. Or we've had people who follow us and are, you know, regular customers of the bus suggest different authors to us. And so those have been, I would say, the primary ways that we've gone about that. And then our book wholesaler that we work with also has some great titles available. And we do try to prioritize those books that people might not be able to find in like a big box book retailer type of situation, or even on online ordering platforms for books. So we've been really lucky in that way. But I would say mostly word of mouth for identifying authors to carry on the bus.
Sydney, I've been hearing for years how ebooks are going to put physical books out of business, A, and B, nobody wants to read anymore. Americans don't read books anymore. You're out in the streets. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I would say that could not be further from the truth. Something that we've really found is that our community in Green Bay, at least, and the surrounding areas really are so willing to support local business, especially women-owned business. The community of small business in Green Bay that we've been able to partner with has been amazing. So I do think that there's something to be said for supporting small business in your local community, and people really seem to be gravitating toward that. And as far as people potentially dropping back on reading a little bit, I would say, especially after the pandemic, people really needed a way to maybe escape, maybe find something joyful in their day. And people, I think, have really started to lean into reading as a form of that, especially romance. We've just seen the romance genre blow up over the past few years. There have been some authors that have put out some really amazing titles and stories. And I would say that we've seen a huge boom around romance reading specifically. Aaron and I both are good testaments to that. So yeah, I would say that there's a huge opportunity out there for readers and for booksellers, and that people are really gravitating toward this right now.
Well, Aaron, if you're willing, let's name some names. Can you give some of the romance authors that either the two of you are into or that you are seeing a lot of demand for from your customers?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, the romantic fantasy genre is absolutely just blowing up. A lot of people will be familiar with the A Court of Thorns and Roses series by Sarah J. Maas. That is one of our most sought after titles, absolutely. Along with some others, we've got Callie Hart with the Quicksilver series. That one has been phenomenal. Rebecca Yaros with the Fourth Wing series. Those are all a little bit kind of on the fantasy romance side. On the contemporary romance side, we have a lot of people asking for Abby Jimenez, which is an author who she's based out of Minneapolis. We've got Emily Henry, who has been putting out just amazing books that are a lot of them actually going to be book to movie adaptations, which is kind of fun. Beyond that, we have a lot of people looking at the thriller section. Freida McFadden is a huge one, as well as Kristen Hanna with some historical fiction. On top of those kind of big names, we also are, we have found a niche in our area with a couple of local authors. One of their pen names is Mae Marvel. It is a local couple who writes together. They write romance together, Annie Mayer and Ruthie Knox. They both write separately and then also together as Mae Marvel. And we have found that their books, we can't keep them on our shelves. It's been so fun to partner with a local author like that and see their books do so well on our shelves.
I'm going to give you a quick fill in the blank exercise. If I weren't busy doing something else, I would be reading blank right now. Sydney, let's start with you. What are you filling that blank with?
So in full transparency, I'm the ish part of romance ish. So really I'm starting to get into romance so much. I've very much been enjoying this romance journey, but traditionally at heart, I'm more of a thriller kind of gal, and I would say anything by Stephen King.
All right. And then how about you, Aaron?
I think for me, I'm going to go with the book Everyone I Kiss Since You Got Famous, which is actually by Mae Marvel. It's set here in Green Bay, and it is just a lovely, cute little rom-com story that just allows you kind of escape the day-to-day, you know, that we're dealing with in the world. And it's fun to see something kind of nestled into my hometown in that way. So that would be my recommendation for sure.
And we'll leave it there. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. This was great.
And Sydney, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. Appreciate you all.
Aaron Sherwood and Sydney Vassell own Loom and Laura Bookmobile in Green Bay. We're talking about their mobile bookstore in its first year on the road in the Green Bay area. It's film festival season in Wisconsin. The Beloit International Film Festival kicked off yesterday. The Milwaukee Film Festival has been running through the month. And the Wisconsin Film Festival starts April 9th in Madison. Next week on the show, we'll get a preview and meet the Wisconsin screenwriter who created the John Wick franchise and hear about his latest movie starring Bob Odenkirk. And we want to hear from you. Do you get out to your local film festival? Is there another film fest in the state any time of year that you want to put in a plug for? Tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org Or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Mackenzie Crummy, and Royce Podeswa. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.